Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Let's think of the Visionary Activist Show also as Democratic Animism Now. What shall we ladle out of the cauldron? Sane, reverent ingenuity, humbly cooperating with nature's guiding genius would be good for a start. A restoration of intimacy to the world always turns out better when Venus design and intimacy leads Mars woofiness. Just a simple thing, right? Leaders gathered to combat and fight climate change. It's like, no, no, no. Even just a simple thing, and then fights are breaking out. Leaders gathered to humbly cooperate with nature's guiding genius, that would be a good reach, but leaders gathered to cooperate with nature. So we have two splendid guests, one here, one we're working because it's all fluid. But first, let me do a community announcement from our great ally, Carmen Snyder, our worthy teammate, because community, micro and macro, weaving things together. So this weekend, she says, since 1973, the Sonoma County Farm Trails has produced the Gravenstein Apple Fair as our primary annual fundraiser to help us fulfill our mission of supporting diversified agriculture and keeping farms forever in Sonoma County. So it is this weekend. It's a wonderful thing to turn out. It's a reciprocal blessing. It's Saturday, August 14th, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Regal Ranch Park in Sebastopol. And farm-to-table food, arts and crafts, cider, craft beer, wine, and community. There we have it. So, all is fluid, like the ocean. We are working on getting our guest Michael Stocker's microphones to work. We're playing with that. But how wonderful. Swooshing in is our ally Dave Gallo, swooshing into place, deep ocean scientist, that we may spiral forth the swoosh of ocean guiding us to appropriate design response. Dave Gallo is director of special projects, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, and is an American oceanographer and director of special projects. For more than 25 years, David has been at the forefront of ocean exploration, participating in and being witness to the development of new technologies, and scientific discoveries that shape our view of planet Earth. He's been described by TED conferences, do check those out, as an enthusiastic ambassador between the sea and those of us on dry land, as is our ally Michael when we finally get to him. There we go. So I love this. May we all be that. David is becoming increasingly outspoken about the relationship between humanity and the sea. He feels strongly that instead of taking the oceans for granted, we need to recognize the ocean's critical role in providing the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat. And at the same time, Dr. Gallo feels that human activity has impacted the ocean on a global scale and with significant consequences. The ocean holds the clues to our past and the key to our future, yet they remain mostly unexplored and poorly understood. Welcome, David Gallo.
Hi, Caroline. How are you doing?
Great, and I love our dance. As many listeners will remember, we replayed at the end of June a fantastic show I did with David Gallo in, I think, July of 2010, right? And we have not spoken since then, but we had a great synchronous email in which I heard from you, and somehow the radio promo showed up in your iPhone. I still don't know how that happened. How did that happen?
Well, everything happens for a reason. But now, one big change is that I've retired from Woods Hole.
Yes.
And yet I'm busier than ever. So
right.
I've sort of left the world of science not behind, but I'm doing things now that more interest me, which is, what is this all about? Which is right down your alley, or up your alley, or across your alley.
Right. Well, no, I like to encourage everyone to replace the word retired with available. So you're available. Your sales are up, and I think for all of us, really, you know, just our dedication. It's like, all right, we're all available. May it be, you know, dance us into place where we can do the most good, have the most fun, and contribute our gifts to the community in a manner of reciprocal blessing. Right. So we're still working on Michael Stocker, but I did send you his piece on, like, wind farms maybe haven't really thought this through. When we get him, he can say more about that. But it's that idea of, you know, collaborating collaborative design with the ocean is his point that I will let him make, God's may it be so, when he joins us, the whales, you know, are not used to these obstacle courses. And he says, you know, like beluga whales have been the same form for 6 million years, and they dive down and scoop up things, and to put these rigid obstacles in their place, the whale could break its jaw because all kinds of things. So do you have a thought on how better we might design this?
You're asking me or Michael?
Yes, I am. Michael's not yet with us. Oh, he is. He is.
Yeah,
oh, wait.
No,
okay. You are. All right. Welcome. Oh, everybody. Yes, we love colleagues meeting. We're all here. That's wonderful. So, yes, ocean scientist, marine acoustician, jazz musician Michael is dedicated to all true chorusing on this planet and many other great things. But his website, ocr.org, is an excellent place to sign up for his missives. Great. Welcome, Michael, and let me toss it to you. And I'm so glad that you and Dave are here cahooting.
Yeah, I'm honored to be in your in both of your presence and company here. I'm really pleased to have gotten this through. I'm using the wax paper and comb version. We managed to get through, but here we are. I'm not sure what it sounds like on the side. But I did catch the last of your questions. And, you know, you were basically talking about what we were conversing yesterday in terms of the offshore wind farms and taking, you know, vast expanses, 400 square miles in the case of the Central Coast, California coast, of what used to be ocean, open ocean, or still is, but is going to be essentially, you know, a forest of equipment and cables and things like that. And just to get an idea of what might be at stake here, because we're not sure if these animals, they certainly don't have in their vocabulary, adaptive vocabulary, the idea that they're going to be swimming around and feeding in a forest of wires and cables and other types of equipment. But they may adapt. It's hard to say. The rorquals, which are the blue whales and the fin whales and the minkies and what have you, when they feed, they do this what's called lunge feeding. So they'll kind of sneak up on a kind of an aggregation of krill or small fish, anchovies or smelt or what have you, and then they'll lunge at it and open their jaws. And the lunge happens at about 6 meters a second, which is a little over 20 kilometers an hour, which works itself out to be about 13 miles an hour. So a fast run. If you're a runner, that would be about how fast you would run. And if you all of a sudden hit something, it's going to hurt. What they do is they open their bottom jaw to about 90 degrees to their body, and they have these pleated gullet, and that opens up, and they're able to contain in that gullet about their body weight in water that has all these critters in it that they are feeding on. And then they'll close their mouth, and they'll press the water out and filter the food through their baleen. And it's a beautiful, an amazing thing in of itself. But if you have your jaw open 90 degrees and all of a sudden hit a 4-inch diameter or 6-inch diameter cable that's rigid or some other piece of equipment, that might not be so good. And that's one of my concerns with this. I should back up a second also and say that, you know, I'm not naysaying on offshore wind, because, you know, we really need to pivot away from fossil fuel. If it's not any clearer than it was on Monday when the IPCC report came out saying that the red lights have stopped flashing, the dashboard, the engine is on fire, so we need to pivot away from fossil fuel. How we do that is going to be a monumental task, and, you know, we have to look at it in terms of balance of harms. So we need to talk about other energy supplies that are sustainable and not so damaging to the planet. But because of just the magnitude of our energy needs right now, we're not just going to, you know, unplug the pipeline and plug in the power cable. We should talk also about energy conservation. And that is, you know, going to be,
right,
you know, as we talk about these types of damages that may be occurring as a consequence of these, you know, new wind farms, we have to say, you know, balance of harms is a discussion.
Right. Well, we go back to our conversation, David Gallo, from 2010, completely pertinent for now, in which you said, you know, the whole way of learning and teaching, we want to, you know, guide humans for complexity, informed complexity, and to understand the ocean and the earth and those everything, you know, as a symphony, you know, and that humans could join back in, right? So in that respect, do you have a thought about, you know, humans going, all right, wind farms, dum, 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 without due consideration?
Well, let me say first, I agree completely with everything Michael just said. And hello, Michael. And and in fact, this is kind of right down. You described it as a symphony, and we talked about it as symphony. And Michael is jazz. Sometimes it's more jazz than symphony, but I still maintain it. Everything is music in one form or another. And just today, I was speaking with some people that talked about, well, we've made this mess here. I think it was with a coral reef. So we'll take one from over here. It was in the southern hemisphere. This was in the problem was northern hemisphere, and we'll replace it. I said, you know, it doesn't really work quite that way, that we can get into this natural symphony, rhythms and cycles, and then throw our own notes in there and expect it to be flow the same way that nature had intended. And I agree with those words that you said, Carolyn, is that we should have thought this through better. And on Cape Cod, where I live on Cape Cod, so I'm surrounded where I am now, three sides by water, and now wind farms are popping up and causing trouble, you know. Just as Michael said, we have to worry about not only the physical barriers, but also things like noise, the vibrations of certain frequency that might bother marine mammals and other life forms. So, you know, we've got, it's pretty clear that we've done things sort of wrong or by the seat of our pants up until now, and we can't have that anymore. I mean, the stakes are too high right now, so right. We need to start thinking things through.
And then in the mytho astro guiding weaving, you know, we say, you know, it's etiquette. We're allowed to set in motion anything of which we would be the happy recipients. And I like a bold one. May it be that all humans have an increasing empathic experience of the effect of their actions on others. And it's like, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Look, you know, would we do that every styrofoam cup, every, you know, thought he'd, sure, let's have that. Because what you're describing, both of you, really is, you know, in learning, you know, the pause going, now, how might this affect others? Right, you know, that humans break out of this, just, you know, I've got mine, because it is all one story, right? So it's like, and how might this influence things? And I mean, do either of you have any suggestions about what the ocean would request or put in as a wind farm possibility, going, how about this completely floating? Or I don't know. I mean, you both are the science grown-ups.
The mechanics of this are really, yeah, I mean, you're really asking about some significant changes. That being said, you know, the discussions that we're having, I have to say, are a lot more in-depth than the discussions that were had 100 years ago, and where then people may have been discussing what the impacts of fossil fuel extraction and burning was going to be. But they're very conscientious now, and they're talking about baselining. They're talking about concerns for birds and fish and, you know, kind of across all taxa. The conversations are there. The work is, you know, it's not necessarily being done at the clip. We would actually need it, but the conversations are being had, and, you know, they're actually talking to indigenous leaders of the various areas, because they actually have a bit of knowledge that goes back a lot longer. And, you know, what is their take? What is the Chumash take on the Central Coast wind farm? Or if there's something that's going on, they're talking about off of Vandenberg Air Force Base. I mean, it's, you know, there are places there that have not just biological significance, but cultural significance. And so the conversations are being had. I have to say, I'm pleased about that. That being said, they're happening at an incredible clip. I mean, between the end of July and middle of September, there were something like 14 or 15 environmental impact statements or environmental assessments that are waiting our comments, and we're furiously writing away and contributing to these kind of collective or collaborative comments where we have a lot of experts, you know, trying to figure out how to fill in the spaces as fast as possible. But they're moving and they're talking about it, so I would say that's an improvement.
And you'd said backstage. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that you'd said that one of the good things is in many, many groups around the ocean are collaborating, unlike the earth-based groups, not so much environmental collaboration. Is that
conversing? Yeah, I found this in environment. David, you probably have a similar experience where there's a lot more kind of cross-pollination. You can't really put fences up in the ocean, and one of the things that lends itself to is a more systematic view of what's happening. And the kind of one of the artifacts of that is that when we're working on these comments, you know, we have legal experts who are on it, but also people who are fisheries biologists and people who are, you know, people from Audubon who are, you know, concerned about the birds. And we're really conferring with each other and trying to come up with the best set of compromises and the best set of recommendations that we are sharing with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, so that they kind of know that, you know, that we're watching and we want it to done, you know, we want it done in the least damaging way. So I think the collaboration is something that might be part of the texture of ocean conservation work and ocean science.
And then, unconstrained by the compelling illusion of realism, let me just go, you know, mad whimsy. What about, you know, John Kerry clones on windsurfing boards? You know, I mean, is there any way to get communities involved in which the activity could be tapped in? I know this is not practical for the grown-up scientists, but I think mad whimsy is like, how could we, who brought what, where's the thing, you know, could we get an army of windsurfers tapped into generating electricity, like people at the gym generating the power to run the gym?
I love the idea. The sheer magnitude of the energy that we're using.
But
we have to bring
it's
up
a fun vision,
less energy. Yeah, it's a fun vision. But using less energy, actually getting out on the bicycle as opposed to the automobile might be one way of doing that. And it's not a matter of generating more energy, it's using less.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, we spoke about that, and I'm here to testify. Due to infrastructure breakdown at my house, there is no air conditioning this summer, and we're all, you know, at 87 degrees inside, and it's fine. So I just want to, if everybody turned their thermostat, you know, to 87, that could help some too. But yes, that's a good point. So David Gallowen, now that you're available to be, you know, the winds of synchronicity blow you where you can do the most good, what is of greatest concern to you now?
Oh, boy. Well, as Michael said, you know, this is a different time than it was even 10 years ago or 5 years ago, where it does seem like suddenly there is a realization. There's a realization that something's got to change, that we better pay attention to what's going on. And that's one big step. I have to say, you keep using the word grown-up scientists, and I don't know where that happens. So
I'll throw it into the cauldron. it's the internalized inquisition still in me. I will release it now. There we go. I will uncringe. I will uncringe.
Right. I'm impressed with that. You know, one thing I think that's important is that we start speaking plain English to people, because I think people get confused. And in fact, if I were trying to unplug some of these things, for the sake of maybe a dollar or some gold or Bitcoin, it'd be fairly easy to do, because you can inject enough doubt. I mean, COVID's a great example of that. You can, if you just use scientific jargon, it's easy to throw doubt into the minds of people. But I think straight talk right now is important, that everything we do is on the record. So what you put in your backyard, what you put on your city streets, so what you put into the atmosphere eventually makes its way down to the sea. And there's and we have to be mindful of that. So I think Michael said something like, you know, learning to minimize, to adapt, to mitigate all those things, because climate change is here. It's happening. It's not something that we expect. It's just that it's, we don't know how bad it could get in the future. But and sometimes I like to just reduce that down to the word pollution, that we shouldn't put things into the ocean or atmosphere and minimize anything that we do, but don't put anything there if we don't absolutely have to, because, you know, we're actually mucking with our, you could think of it as a terrarium and an aquarium, but we're messing with the chemistry and the temperature of the waters and the air, and anyone that's got either one of those knows that that's a recipe for disaster. So, you know, I'm optimistic that we're seeing this activity from places I never thought we'd see that kind of activity. I must admit, I'm surprised that the dollar has not popped up yet, at least not in my world. I haven't seen people being greedy about it. So I'm fairly optimistic. I think, you know, we need to go that one step further. And I've spent some time doing that since I retired, which is to think more about, I mean, that's the number one thing, is that our condition, the human condition on this planet. But then there's, I think, another question of what does this all mean? You know, what, where did, it's that whole, this is classic questions. Where do we come from? Where are we? And we are, where are we going? And I think those are powerful. When we say we're attached to the sea, why? Why are we attached to the sea? Why are we so drawn by sunsets and sunrises and the full moon? And those aren't scientific questions necessarily. You know, there's something bigger there that I think, I hope more and more people take the time to try to understand that.
Well, let me, you both of you always remind me of scientists with artist souls, of poets. And let me just bring in a quote from Lauren Isley, you know, that addresses what you just said, David Gallo. We are rag dolls made out of many ages and skins, changelings who have slept in wood nests or hissed in the uncouth guise of waddling amphibians. We have played such roles for infinitely longer ages than we have been men. Our identity is a dream. We are process, not reality, for reality is an illusion of the daylight, the light of our particular day. Thank you, Lauren Isley. Mm. Which is very much nice. what you were bringing up, Dave Gallo. The immense journey. Yeah, and these questions, you know, the conversations, absolutely, and then, you know, using less energy. What does this all mean? You know, tracking it all the way back. You know, how did we get here? You know, in the middle of a fairy tale, you know, people who are lost in the woods do many things that don't work. They yell and scream and cry, you know, and then finally they sit down and they tell themselves their own story about how they came to be there in the forest. And there's something about telling our own story. The magic horse arrives, the stairway descends, you know, synchronicity intervenes, you know. So, you know, telling our micro and macro story, how did we all get here, and who brought what, you know, and I guess it's that invitation. So everything's connected. Our last week's guests, Dr. Rupa Marya and Raj Patel, with their pretty great massive work called Inflamed, and it's you know, it's science and deep delving, and I mean, and it's all one story. And I said to them last week, and to Michael backstage, you know, but I found it's all speaking to us. They said that, you know, one of their colleagues at UCSF who got COVID and lost her sense of smell, and then even though she wasn't near any fires, all she could smell was forest burning. That was part of the COVID symptomology. Boy. I'm like, whoa, it's all speaking. Yeah, so how shall we cool that out? Well, okay, so it is an opportune time, right, to reinvent and redesign things, and glad you're optimistic. And then let's just bring in everything, right? Because Michael, you had a great metaphor. I don't know if we can refine it again when I said, you know, all viruses, right? It's everything real is also a metaphoric, you know, how shall we cooperate? And, you know, I've been saying for a while they mutate in an hour, right? And we humans need to change that fast. We could maybe strike up a deal. But you said, Michael, that viruses are creative disruption, and they play like kinetics
with
DNA.
Mutagens. They're mutagens. Yeah, I'd say playing coyote with a DNA wasn't good. But we wouldn't have multicellular organisms on the planet if we hadn't had viruses to come and disrupt the kind of microbes and tell them to behave in ways that they were not necessarily initially designed to do. And so that's a good virus. Well, maybe they're all good viruses because we're being asked to change in very dramatic ways right now. And we're seeing it. We're seeing it in sociopolitically. And there's a lot of things that have come up in the last 18 months, which have really, I like that, what you said, stopping and telling our own story. We've been having to face our own story and actually recast it and say, what does it actually mean? Or where do I sit in this story of mine right now? And how did we get here? And that is one of the questions that this COVID has asked us to dwell on. And we're seeing a lot of it. And some of it, people are afraid of their own stories. We're seeing people who are, busting out the gates. I mean, I like these kind of interesting, what can I say? It's white Christians on fear, where they're going, you can't say that story. We don't want to hear that story. We're going to fine you if you say that story. It's like, stop. What is wrong with this discussion that we're trying to have here? And this is one of the things that this mutagen, has brought out in us, is we've got these really extreme, like, woo, well, does that make sense where we are? Is that going to actually cultivate our most cost and time efficient or elegant way of surviving? Maybe not. And that's becoming pretty obvious in some cases.
Well, and let me toss it back to you, David Gallo, because Michael and I were talking about is asking us to change and commonwealth, the community. We're all in this thing together. Mm. That the conversation then about universal health care and everyone needs everyone to have health care, right? Common goals. Right, and there's a wonderful novel by Terry Pratchett called Thief of Time. I just very briefly, but it's there's a great character, Death. But humans are behaving so badly that Death says, "You're putting me out of business." Right, you're being so stupid. You're putting Death out of business. And so everyone needs everyone to have health care, commonwealth. And let me toss back my love of the ocean back to you, Dave Gallo. For as long as humans have had imagination, it's always been tied to the sea, right? It's, yeah. And we then say, what species would pollute the ocean? And we go, a species that had no mythology of collaborative kinship, and only the healing of our imagination can allow us to heal the sea, and only the healing of the sea can allow us to heal imagination. But let me toss it back to yourself. So we have commonwealth, and people are going, no commonwealth, I've got mine. But it's boundaries for dedicated community freedom is now before us, right? And is that part of your optimism, David Gallo?
Well, first of all, when I say I'm more optimistic. I mean, more is the point, relativistically. I'm not totally optimistic, but I'm right. More than I've ever been. And, I like to look at this. I'm staring at a globe at the moment that there's no trace of us on that globe, and from space at that distance of who knows what, 5,000 miles, there's no trace of humanity. So we are, in fact, like a microbe on this planet, and like a microbe, we've managed to change this planet in a way. And in this case, Michael said good viruses, I think we've been a fairly bad virus. When you say commonwealth, in fact, I just had this discussion last night. The idea that, when we say we're worried about the future of our children, well, who are we talking about? Our own children or our neighbors, our neighborhood, our village, our city, state, country? Because there are billions of people, billions of people that are hoping to make it till tomorrow. Right. So and to talk to them about, you know, don't use plastics and that kind of thing, you know, I think that's something we need to be mindful of, is that there are so many people, so when we talk about Commonwealth, if we're really serious about it, we need to worry about them too, not just us.
Right, no. Pause. This is a big conversation. We're going to take a very short music break. Our splendid guests are Michael Stocker and David Gallo, and our The Ocean and Everything, and we will be right back after this very short break. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. We are hosting the Humpback Whales, as well as Michael Stocker and David Gallo, great ocean scientists and guides, right? So, yes, that was a surprise, but perfect, perfect. Yeah, ingenuity. We'll come back to Commonwealth. But since the whales insisted, and perfectly so, you know, Michael, I was saying along the shore that, you know, there's so few important crab creatures, whatever that everybody uses, but very few. Birds, even seagulls. I don't know. Are there very few seagulls where you are, David Gallo?
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, we have plenty of seagulls. Just throw a small crumb of bread or a half a French fry under the sand, like many children do, and in no time at all, we'll have tens, if not 100, seagulls swooping around. So.
I'm glad. We send some down here. Horseshoe crabs. There's the word came back to me. So few horseshoe crabs. The segue was, I remember as a little girl walking on the beach with my sister, and she pointed out a horseshoe crab and said, "Look, they've been in the same form for 2 million years because they're perfect." Mm. That stayed with me forever, and I said that to you, Michael, and you were saying, "Well, the humpback whales have been in the same form for 6 million years, and every year their song changes." Do you want to describe what we just heard?
Yeah. So the humpbacks have this remarkable cultural legacy that each of the breeding groups will sing a song. The males sing the song, and the females that we suppose are listening. But typically, when you're talking about sexually dimorphic behavior, where a male does something or looks like something or what have you, and the female does not, that it has something to do with breeding fitness announcement or territorial establishment or what have you. But
he's gone underwater. Okay. Is Michael, are you there? No, Michael just went underwater. But what he was going to say... we'll see. Michael Stalker is very much like as though some sea creature put on human garb and started to walk the earth. But it's taken him back for the brief moment. We'll see. But what Michael was saying was, you know, every year the humpback whales, their song changes, but the same song is sung drifting west to east by all the humpback whales globally. And he said sometimes a 3-week delay for the song elements to drift. And we go, there we go.
That's a beautiful thing, so, really, in my mind, as long as it indicates something not bad. In fact, there's one whale we always call it the lonely whale that sings at a different frequency than all the other whales. But for many, many, many years, we listened to him out in the Pacific Ocean. I don't know anyone ever saw what it was, who was making that sound, but I always thought that was fairly wonderful too.
What it's the lonely whale with his lonely whales blues song?
Yeah, we can ask Michael, but it's one single whale that has his own song or his own frequency that lives in. So it's not a pod, just one single whale, and out there. It's kind of sad in some ways, but it's. I always found it very interesting to think that there he is, and kind of reassuring that year after year we could hear that. Well, we knew he was okay and out there. But, you know, by and large, it's a great planet. We have had such an incredible opportunity as a species to think of the things that we do. We think about the infinity. We think about the infinitesimal. We think about the split second, and then we think about a longer time period. It's just eternity. So, what a great opportunity! And I think we've sadly, up until now, we've wasted a lot of it.
Right. Well, and then. While we're aspiring to get Michael back on the phone there, okay. But from his underwater realm. So part of my love of liberating Trickster in all forms in nature, it's the resilience that, you know, seeds sprout after cataclysm, and it's, you know, coyote and raven and ingenuity. And having lived with a coyote for 19 years, I know about wheeling and dealing, and I think this is a crucial thing, and it's part of the collaboration. You know, I was watching, I was a particular insect that sucks the sap of this tree, and the tree likes that because in return, that particular insect protects the tree from herbivores. And I'm like, right, it's all a deal, right? But our species credibility is at an all-time low. Right. I mean, in every way, you know, it's like we betrayed the Kurds. We're betraying the Afghani translators. You know, it's like America's word on the line, you know, is terrible. And it's all one fabric. Right. So I know from cooperating with the coyote going, if I give you two of these, will you give me one of that? You know, and you work out a thing.
Yeah.
We need to really rebuild trust that we will keep our collaborative agreement. Don't you think?
Oh, I absolutely do, and I think about that in my more depressing times of this aggression. And I just wish we could stamp it out. You know, it sounds like I'm advocating aggression, but if you watch us as a species from the moon, you think we were out of our minds because we spend so much of our money, so much of our time trying to undo one another, trying to kill one another, and it's that opportunity I talked about to have this lovely planet and to enjoy each other and the world around us is lost because we go back. You know, is that really the nature of humanity that we want? If there's a tree growing with branches that we want to make a branch into the club and beat someone over the head with it, I hate to think that. So, I think you're right. It's almost like you read my mind, and maybe you have, because these are all issues. You know, the thing that I'm so interested these days in the biome, the microbiome, and how important that is, of the soil, for instance, and the idea that trees can communicate, and the idea that our gut biome has changed over time, where if you look at less developed, I guess which one way to call it, society, their gut biome's closer to being in the same, in sync with nature, and ours is out of sync because of all the silly things we put into our system. And but I am so captivated by that because I think it's really fundamentally important. But we get hung up on the big things. Well, you know, we want the big stuff. We want the asteroid impacts, and we want the tsunamis or volcanic eruptions. But a lot of it, and that's a problem with the oceans in a way, is that a lot of what happens is incremental baby step things like flame retardants and plastic chemicals. And you can't see it. It's not an event. It's a continuum, and it's tough to get people to pay attention. I'm sorry I've wandered. But I haven't really talked to anyone all day, so you're getting me in blabber mode.
No, that's completely great. No, it's Neptune dreams, vision, space out, reverie, pausing. Yeah. Meandering is completely welcome. That's right, we want meandering. And remember the German scientist with all the floods said, you know, we might have made a mistake forcing rivers into shallow, straight cement channels. That might have been a mistake.
So many mistakes, yes, in the way we think of nature. And actually, I think, and there's a growing group of us, maybe we'll be stamped out, thinking that we got science wrong. You know, we do a lot of these early ideas that go back to the 16th and 17th century. It turned into dogma. And then we concoct these things, quantum physics, dark matter, and it all sounds so good, but I don't know that we got it right to begin with. And in my bookshelf behind me, I'm looking at what I've got. Where it used to be science books, I've now got the Book of Symbols, Signs and Symbols.
Oh, great.
Loving every bit of it and looking at each.
Oh, look, our libraries are merging. I have Sir Claude's Dictionary of Symbols right at hand right here, and as well as Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable and World Mythology.
I think that's where the truth is, and I think, you know, we need to go back a bit, and I'm not meaning to offend anyone. I'm a God believing human being. I believe in a God, but you know, religion, it tends to be a human construct, and so does science, a human construct. So if we could just push back beyond that, or at the early stages before they got developed, and I think we might find a whole different way of thinking about life. And in fact, mixed with all my books, I've got Emily Post's Etiquette and Etiquette for Men.
that's very charming. Yes. Well, we do want our species to have manners. And here's Mike. Speaking of manners, Michael is back. Can I remind you of a mannered conversation that you had years ago, Michael, on the show? Or actually, backstage to the show, in which I had author Michael Gruber, author of Esoteric Thrillers, on, and you both discovered that you had PhDs in predator-prey relations, right?
Well, roughly. I studied music.
That's how I remember it.
I'll go with that.
Let me continue to quote or misquote you, then toss it back about manners. Emily Post, yes, but also intrinsic to nature, because the conversation that you both had in my memory is that predator prey have manners, and the example that you both used in my memory was that if a prairie dog is outside its little home, and there's an eagle overhead, it communicates. I think it raises its eyebrows in my memory, and communicates to the hawk, like, no, look how close I am to my little hidey hole. Don't waste your energy. And the hawk says, thank you very much. I'll eat you later, and spirals off, right? And, you know, and I like Lawrence Vanderpost, you know, saying, even though he was a stiff dingbat in many ways, but he almost got killed, eaten by a lion. And he said, you know, terrible pain, terrible fear. And then at the last moment, he was like, fantastic ecstasy. And we go, I'm rooting for that. But science into dogma, let's go back to that thing. It's why, you know, heresy, to be a heretic, was a term of praise in early religion, when early religion was more tolerant, because it meant cross-pollinating free thinking, contributor to community to ensure that nothing degraded into dogma, right? It just cross-pollinating what you're talking about, the biome, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, that's wonderful.
Well, I think the original theologies, if you will, were really systems thinking in the making, where people are sitting there going, well, how do these things relate to each other? And by telling stories about them or by embodying the relationship itself, that ends up, say, becoming systematic thinking. I think where we ran off the rails a little bit, or continue to run off the rails, is it's a responsibility to constantly be in a relationship with your surroundings. And a lot of people may find it easier to acquiesce to somebody else's interpretation, and they don't have to necessarily take on the burden of constant engagement. James Nestor who's a free diver, talks about diving with the white sharks, and you would think that these animals are deadly predators, but he said that once you establish eye contact with them, they recognize you as a predator as well, and then play starts.
He talks about
Being able to grab the pectoral fin of a shark, and it'll swim down, it'll shake them off, and they'll come back and pick them up again. And it becomes a plaything, because at that point in time, like the prairie dog and the hawk say, actually, the relationship we have right now is not predator-prey. We have, we're cohabiting this particular thing. I'm going to make your life easier so you don't have to chase me, and I'm going to make your life easier because you can spend your time doing something more productive.
Where are we at with that?
That was the prairie dog, and the hawk.
I see. Okay, we're back there.
I saw this really amazing thing. It was a baboon. No, it was a warthog who was kind of trotting along, and there was a bunch of sleeping lions behind this tree, and the warthog kind of stumbles into it and goes, "Oh my God!" and runs. And the lions get up because their nap was interrupted, and the expressions on their face, they don't want to anthropomorphize this too much, but it's like, what was that guy thinking? It was like they're looking at each other like, what just happened here? And, this is something that was outside of, they weren't hunting at the time, they were napping, and the warthog was just trotting around, looking for food or something to do, and all of a sudden runs into a whole pride of lions. It's like, oh my God. But
they definitely respond
to each other in behavioral ways, mannered ways, right?
Right, and then I just want to bring up our ally David Grimes' story about his friend walking with her baby on a backpack in Alaska, and they round the corner and come into a mother grizzly bear with her cubs, and the mother grizzly bear goes, and the baby on the human's back leans around and goes, and the grizzly goes, oh, you're a mom, I'm a mom, cool. So you're a predator, I'm a predator. Okay, well, finding kinship in some way. So, yes, I love Alan Watts said the problem with Western man and Christianity is they suck the finger instead of going where it pointed. So there could have been something useful there. But let's see. Where shall we go? Let me toss this one back to you, David Gallo. I also like Neil Douglas Klotz, Aramaic scholar, and went... the vernacular Jesus would have spoken, and everybody at that time. And he said, when Jesus says, be as wise as serpents and as gentle as doves, the word he uses is the same word for serpent, Eve, and wisdom. And so I said to Neil, I go, so all religious war and suppression and killing of the earth and suppression of everything, is a translation error? And he goes, yeah, pretty much intentional translation error. But so now we come back. So David Gallo, are you working for kinship?
Sure. I think so. Of course. you just bring me back to, I'm stuttering because you bring me back to, I don't want to name drop, but I was at a dinner once, and there were name cards on the dinner table, around the table. And so I kind of walked and snuck to see who I was sitting next to, and it said Madeleine Albright. And I said, I wonder, it can't be. But I thought then again, how many Madeleine Albrights could it be? And I said, my God, what are we going to talk about? And I started talking about tolerance and tolerance between humans and peoples and nature. And she said, no, no, it's not tolerance. We need acceptance. And I thought, wow, that is very interesting, because that's exactly right, that I shouldn't be sitting here saying I've got the right way of doing things. And, you know, like it's like saying, yeah, sure, we can have kinships as long as it's according to my rules. But sure. I mean, I think kinships is a great goal, but it's got to be a shared. There's got to be acceptance inside there of the way other people think, the way other people do. And I can't go any further than that. That's a great question, and now I'm going to be thinking about that tonight.
Do you remember what brooch Madeleine Albright was wearing?
I don't. All I do remember is that she had a fantastic sense of humor, and I enjoyed the moment. I was a bit happy when dinner ended that I escaped. I didn't spill whatever it was, all of pilaf all over the front of me. But she was very.
I think tolerance is also we add tolerance and acceptance into the brew. That was a little intolerant of Madeleine to say no. But the reason I bring it up is I can hear some of the dedicated KPFA listeners going, Madeleine Albright was a war criminal and collateral damage. And we go, yes, nobody's perfect. That is true. Also, but again, we go for the part we can relate to, nuance. Be fully informed of the critique, but she is famous for her brooches, symbolic.
Yeah.
She would turn herself into a tarot card, and all the world leaders were like, oh, what's she wearing today? You know, it reveals her. And that, just to toss back to you both, but that idea of, restoration of intimacy, to be able to read the world symbolically as though it were a dream, and there's a part of her that is in there. That's really great. Tolerance, acceptance, wherever we'd like to go. There are forever chemicals, and I want to come back to the biome and toss it to both of you. But humans have created these toxic chemicals called forever chemicals that apparently, according to human knowledge, will never go away. Right? Is that right? Michael?
That is true. That is true.
Yeah.
I mean, the plastic thing, when you go take hydrocarbons out of a deposit, it's not oil or gas. It's just glop. And it's got all kinds of stuff in it. And they send it to a refinery. And they refine the stuff out of it that they can't immediately use. And, sell the fossil fuel that they can burn. But now they have all this, effluvia that's all this other stuff. So what do they do with it? Well, I live not too far away from the Chevron refinery that's across the bay in Richmond. And what do they make with it there? What is this stuff? God, it's poisonous. Oh, God, what do we do? Let's use it for poison. And they, so the Ortho insecticide factory is over there, and they use that. And then plastic, and they're basically, they have this huge now ethane cracker that's going in western Pennsylvania, because they had all this ethane that was coming out of these fracked wells. And what do we do with this stuff? Well, let's make plastic out of it. And so, it's the largest ethane cracker in the known universe right now, and they're going to be basically turning out all this toxic forever stuff that really should actually remain in the ground, underneath us all, and not to be pulled out. So, and we're inventing this stuff, but chemists are coming up with incredible compounds that they are, reconstructing out of the stuff that we're pulling out of the earth. And it's, the footprint is going to be quite large for eternity. Let's put it that way.
Right. And then back to you, David Gallo, all weaving, that you said, there are people who are just, can we make it to the next day? Yes, there are. And so they're not concerned about, the plastic part. And we go, yeah. Although there was some show I heard late at night driving around, Marin, probably on KPFA, but it was someone who said, there are many kinds of ingenuity, and the ingenuity that comes out of hardship is very often the most valuable. And he said, you know, Americans are very soft, you know, in a way. No, we can, this is a complex conversation. It's all going to be simplified, you know. But he said, you know, you go somewhere, you know, really impoverished, and you go, I need to charge my phone. And it's like, here's some apple cider vinegar and a string and a bicycle, and there you go. So, yes, I mean, what you said is true. And then it can be that these places can also be places of ingenuity and who brought what and the making of many things out of, you know, hempcrete is, you know, mold resistant and lasts longer and doesn't collapse. And, you know, I mean, all of these. So we're at a great renaissance, really. I mean, potentially, you know, it's like renaissance or death. Take your pick, you know, and you know, a lonely death or, you know, connect with everybody. And but also back to you in the biome. You know, and the intelligence of the gut biome and the trees and the roots and the everything and both of you so dedicated, you know, for humans to be increasingly humbled by increasing awareness of the intelligence of plants, trees, ocean, rock, everything, right? So humbled by intelligence. And do you want to say more on behalf of your biome? David Gallo, is your biome doing well?
Oh, no, my biome is a mess. In fact, I just had long overdue, I guess, back surgery, and I avoided it. And I have so many people suggest do it, don't do it. But I've had 30 years of pain, but a month ago I had back surgery, and my decades of pain are gone. Now I hope they stay gone. But in the process, of course, the antibiotics, the painkillers, the opiates, I'm sure I've made a complete mess. And I have had C. diff, which is lovely, and from antibiotics, where it just wipes out your intestinal structures of biomes, of the microbes. I think I need to, and I keep saying that tomorrow starts my, or tonight or today, I start living a life that thinks more about what I put into my body, and in fact, what I breathe, what I do and don't do, and how much time I spend outside. But I think it's something that a lot of us need to think. You know, we're chasing the almighty dollar. And of all the things
we're on our way out. We're chasing the almighty dollar on our way out all too soon. But perhaps we will reconvene even sooner than people imagine. Back surgery, yes, that was a great story. That's how we connected. Cooperating with everything, going, welcome your opportunity to create a new civilization in your microbiome. Playful. All right. Thank you so much, Michael Stocker. We will be speaking soon. David Gallo, thank you so much. And thanks always to our great board op, Kirsten Thomas, and CoyoteNetworkNews.com. We will reconvene next week. Thank you, team. Woof.